The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We are going to try and hit a balance between what is called in Hebrew, bi'iyun, which means to go into depth, and bikiyut, which means to see a breadth. It's always a balance, you know, it's kind of hard. You're going too fast, going too slow, you're going too deep, you're too shallow. I'll try my best to be as balanced as I can. But I would like to move also, so that people can get a sense of the Chumash. Right? Because very often people sit around for lengthy amounts of time and never get to see a lot either, which to see the rest of Chumash is really crucial to be able to understand this part of Chumash also. Now, really, the other day we really did not define what the Chumash is. What is the Chumash anyways? Is it a history book? Obviously not. Because if you go throughout the Chumash, there's various places that for a history book, it's really lacking. And in other places where you would not expect history, it gives you history. So what is this book anyways? It's certainly not a history book, although we believe that everything in it is factually true, right? But we believe that the Chumash is much, much more than that. When we're learning Bereishit, what's the difference between Bereishit and what's the difference between opening up a physics book? And let's say this physics book, we could know that it's actually true in terms of it is authentic, a complete description of the process of life. So what would be the difference between that and this? And certainly, it would be unimpressive. I once shared with you a story that I heard from Rabbi Refson when he was on an airplane. He was sitting beside a astrophysicist, a PhD, big, well-known astrophysicist. And they were sitting there, and Rabbi Refson, of course, has had many, many years. He's a Torah scholar and learning. And the astrophysicist was a Jewish fellow. And the astrophysicist looks at him and says, "You know, Rabbi, I think you could sum up the entire Torah in just a few words." Like, imagine, he says this to a man who's dedicated his entire life to the study of Torah, and he's a great Torah scholar. He says, "Yes." "Well, what is it?" And he says, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." So Rabbi Rifson looked at him, "Oh, very nice, very nice." He said, "You know, Dr. So-and-so, I believe that you could sum up all of astrophysics in just a few words." "Amazing, amazing, PhD. Well, yes, Rabbi." He said, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star. How I wonder how you are." You know, obviously there's a serious communication gap. If an astrophysicist opens this up, and he's wearing glasses with the expectation to see what he sees in Einstein, he'll pick it up, he says, "No, this I needed a God to write." Right? Einstein is much more impressive than this kind of thing. You have to understand the Chumash is the divine communication to the humankind. What's written in the Chumash is what's important in terms of our relationship with God. And the whole theme of the Torah, as we are going to see, is the evolving relationship of the divine to the human and the human to the divine. That's the theme of the Chumash. Right? That's what Torah is all about. That's what Judaism is all about. The evolving theme of the human relationship to God and the implicit responsibilities that effectualize such a relationship. Because, you know, a relationship without the fulfillment of your responsibility is not a relationship. It doesn't matter how many times he or she say to each other, "I love you, I love you, I love you." If they do not fulfill the implicit responsibilities derivative of that relationship, then it's nothing. Right? And that's the mitzvot. The mitzvot are the derivative acts that manifest and establish the relationship between the human and the divine. So that's what the Chumash is all about. And that's what we're looking for over here. We're looking for relationship. The Zohar says that the Bible really is only one word, and that's the name of God. Right? The name of God, that's all the Bible is. It's just one big word of the name of God. Another Zohar says, no, it's not just one name of God. In fact, every word that you will see in the Chumash is actually another name of God. Right? And if you look at the Birkat HaTorah, the blessings that we say before the Torah, it clarifies why we're studying Chumash. Why are we studying Torah? It says, please God, make your Torah sweet in our mouths, so that we and our children's children should all know your name and learn the Torah for its name's sake. Therefore, the tefillah over there, the prayer, establishes clearly what is the purpose of Torah study? To know God's name. Now, is there anyone here that doesn't know God's name? That makes sense. That's what I need, hundreds of thousands of Jews spending so much time learning Torah, and they, God's name, you know, you go, anybody, what's God's name? God. But to know God's name means to know how to call out to the divine. That's the meaning that God has a name. Right? You don't need a name unless there's someone there to call you. Right? What else do you need a name for? And therefore, the Torah is really the name of God, meaning what? On one hand, of course, a name is the revelation, the understanding of somebody, but it's more than that. A name means I offer you the possibility for a relationship. As I once shared with many people who were alumni of Israelite, that when I was going out with my wife, for a very long time during the dating period, she did not call me by my name. And it was only much later that once we were engaged and that, she told me that, I don't know if you've noticed this, but my family definitely noticed it, that I really never called you by your name. I said, why? It's not such a difficult name to pronounce. She said, because to call you by your name would imply that there exists a relationship between us. And I didn't want to in any way prematurely decide that that was what was going on. A name means there's a relationship, and that's what the Torah is all about. What we're going to learn in terms of the Torah are really two things. In terms of its content, it's telling us about who we are and who we are in relationship to who the divine is. That's what this is all about. Now, there's many other things that are there, but ultimately, that's what it's all about, to know God's name. But in terms of not only content, but in terms of process, which means learning how to learn, there's a possibility for creativity in the Torah. There is the right for every Jew to say what is called pshat. That you can look at the Chumash, and you can ask the questions, you can look at the various commentaries, you can look at the Midrashim, and you say, you know what I think this says? I think it says this. And that is holy right, that you have just participated in bringing more Torah in the world. That really Torah study is not like any other study where you're just simply studying it and what's on the page is on the page. But Torah study is a process of ongoing communication with God right now. When we open up the Chumash, we've actually plugged into an ongoing way of relating to God, and there's an ongoing vessel and revelation that's going to happen right now that we can all be part of. And every year there will be more books of Torah filling the shelves. There are more and more books of Torah coming into the world. Now, did Moses say all this? Yes and no. Because Moses brought into the world that basic broadcasting station that is crucial in order for we little transmitters to tune in and bring more into the world, into our world. And therefore, there are two things happening over here. There's content, and there's beauty in the content in terms of what it provides us in our understanding of our relationship with God. But there's another level that's actually much more living, which is learning. Going in there and saying a pshat, understanding what it says, and you just had it hit you, and you just participated in the revelation of Moshe. Okay? And that is the second thing that we want to concentrate on. Of course, the process is to the extent that you'll do it on your own. We'll do some of it here, and I will try and share with you how I've been taught to do that also. But ultimately, during Beit Midrash time and evenings, you would like to go over it, ask the questions, offer a possible answer. So let's go to the Chumash, and let's start with Bereishit. Now, I'd like you to read over the 7 days of creation. And what I want you to keep in mind is, what is creation? Right? We're talking about creation, but the Chumash is telling us what creation is. So let's look at it. What is creation? What does it mean to be a creative process? First of all, why am I asking this question? What is creation? You know, why is that an important question? We start off with this first sentence in the Torah, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. In the beginning, created God heaven and earth. We clarified yesterday that really, what would we have expected the sentence to say? And this is the first
rule in learning how to learn. Think of what you would have expected and then contrast it to what it is. And if you have a different version than what's there, then you must be missing something and it's saying something that your version would not have said. What would you expect the Chumash to say? God created the world, right? God created the world. In the beginning, God created the world. What do I need in the beginning? Do you see that? What do I need in the beginning? Number one. Number two, what do I need God only after the verb? In the beginning created God heaven and earth. And by the way, we mentioned the other day, there's a famous story of the king of Egypt who at that time was ruling over the Jews in Israel, took 72 of the sages and said, I want you to translate this book. It's called the Septuagint. These 72 rabbis were put in different places so they could not in any way collaborate in terms of how they were translated. And each were given a Ruach HaKodesh, right, which I'm sure you all know what that is, because I already heard what happened in the first class. Ruach HaKodesh, a divine inspiration. And they all translated it the same way. Where there were difficult passages that would have heretical possible interpretations, they changed it. And one of the places was here. What was heretical about this place? What was possibly heretical about this pasuk? Well, in a beginning. It could also be in the beginning. Did. It could be. But why would that be heretical in a beginning? Ah, but that wouldn't be heretical, by the way, because even the Midrash says that God created worlds and destroyed them, created worlds and destroyed them. Oh, no, no, for everybody. In other words, that they didn't want them to get the wrong idea. Now, there's somehow a wrong idea that seems to be here, unless you have oral tradition. Because it says, in the beginning created God. What does that mean? Exactly, exactly. In the beginning created God, not to mention that Elohim is of a plural tense, and therefore God, Elohim, the name God, is multiple divine forces. And therefore, what they did is they, instead of saying in the beginning created God, they said God created in the beginning. Okay? But we know in oral tradition that that's not so. But if that's not so, then why didn't the Chumash write it that way? I mean, it is, obviously, the rabbis see that there's a possible problem in the pasuk, and therefore they change it in translation so that no one would get that mistake. But why didn't God see that problem and put that into the Chumash? Because I mean, it's very crucial that we, God, feels in terms of what we need to know. Which is what? What this is telling us clearly is we encounter God through creation. That the first encounter with God is not God created the world. That wouldn't make any sense to us. The God we know and we encounter is only after creation. Very important idea in Judaism. That we know the divine only in terms of divine acts. We do not know the divine essence in any sense. We do not encounter the divine essence. We encounter creation. And through creation we know God. There are certain other religions that would probably suggest that you can know God without creation. But it's not Judaism. What would be the practical ramifications of a religion that believes you can encounter God without creation? Regardless of the creation, what would be the difference? You'd be very spiritual. You didn't have to be very spiritual. But that's also true. What else? And what's the difference if we know God through His creation, or we say, no, we don't need creation in order to know God? What would that have in terms of practical ramifications, in terms of human living? We would think that the creation is insignificant in terms of our relationship to God, or isn't important, let's say, and that's already the beginning of the end of Judaism. Judaism believes that the way you know God is through His creation, and the way you treat creation is itself a reflection of the way you know God. Okay, because you only know God through creation. And that's an important thing to know over here. Right? That in the beginning, created God, heaven and earth. Only after we see creation do we know God, and only to the extent of creation we know God, and to the extent that we understand creation and we fulfill its purpose, to that extent, do we have the right to say we're coming close to God. That's important. That's the difference between sitting around and meditating all day long and thinking I'm coming close to God, or going out there and doing something for the world. It's a very major difference. Although, of course, Judaism believes in meditation, but meditation is believed to, is seen in Judaism as a preparation to do what we have to do, which is to fulfill our responsibilities in the world. As it says, everyone I'm sure is aware of, everybody has the right to say, for me the world was created. What does that mean? What does that mean, for me the world was created? That sounds like an incredibly egotistical way of living. Hey, for me the world was created, so get off the bus. What does that mean, for me the world was created? I am responsible. If it was for me, then it's mine. I'm responsible for it. And that sense of personal sense that for me the world was created means every person should feel they are responsible for the world. Which, of course, if it was taken to the nth degree, you'd become neurotic. But there are other, thank God, verses in Torah that, of course, balance that out. But there is a sense of responsibility for the world and the sense that the world was created for me. That creation is an act of relating. Now, how do we know creation is an act of relating? And this gets us back to, so what is creation? We've just clarified that why do we need to know what creation is? It's because only through creation we know God. And the God that Jews know is the God that created the world, and anything other than that we don't know. And we don't spend our time on. Okay? But now that we know that the God that we are interested in is the God who created the world, and through the understanding of creation we'll know God, so now we want to understand what creation is. So from this, what is creation? So I suggest creation is an act of relating. And I would like you to show me if I have proof for that in the text. Yeah? Okay, but how that doesn't necessarily imply that God's relating to me. And God is obviously relating to the world. He creates the world. He said, and it is good. That itself is an interesting statement. What did God say was good? Well, it would be bad. That itself is a strange thing to say. Yeah, but there's one thing that I think is very interesting. It says, in the beginning God created heavens and earth. Right? And there was this formless void, chaos, whatever. And Elohim said, let there be light. Who did God say that to? Himself? And what does that mean? Why does the Chumash, what does that mean to me, that God said, let there be light? What would have been different if it would have said, and God created light? In the beginning, God created heavens and earth, and God created light, and God created this, and God created that. What would be the difference? Why does it have to be, and God said, let there be light, and there was light? It's a very strange thing. Why is that so important? Well, first of all, I believe because saying is a communication. Who is God speaking to? So according to some Hasidic thought, God is speaking to us. After the fact of creation, now that we exist, the only time you'll know creation is when you hear, let there be light. If after all your scientific research, after you become the greatest, most brilliant philosopher and scientist in the world, and there you've got it all articulated, and light is mc squared, whatever, in the final analysis, you don't know anything about creation until you have heard the incomprehensible word of God that said, let there be light. If you didn't hear that, you know anything about creation. Until you hear that the world isn't a created world, the world just is, and you have sciences. You know, brilliant in terms of picking it apart, describing it, categorizing it. But after all that, have you met it in terms of a creation? No. Only until you hear the word that God said, let there be light. Now, I'm deriving this from a basic understanding and Hasidic thought that's from a verse that says, forever God's words are in the skies. And Kabbalah says that really at the essence of everything is just the words of God. If we were able to get back to the essence of everything, what would it be? It would be God's words. Right, we see table. But what's really at the root of table? What's at the root of table is the divine word saying, let there be table, let there be table. I know, so what does that mean? It means that everything I see in the world is not simply a creation or something that just exists, but a mode of communication to me. A mode of communication to me. Everywhere I go, I should be able to see and hear the word of God that said, let there be light. And who did God say let there be light for? You and me. Right? For man that we know at the end of the story. So creation from the word let there be, God saying, communicating, right? Communicating to say there must be someone there to hear. So who is there to hear? Nobody so far. But later on, when man comes into the scene, retroactively, we will give meaning to those words when we hear them. And when we hear God say, let there be light, then the world is created. If we don't hear God saying, let there be light, the world is destroyed. The world is destroyed. That's the difference. It will return back to tohu vohu, as it says in the prophets. God says, if not for my covenant, my relationship with man, I would not create heaven and earth. Only to the extent that the human being discovers the dimension of reality, which is the relating side of God relating to us, only to that extent does the world have foundations. Without it, it's all over. But that's more drushy. On a simpler level, what does it mean to say, and God said, let there be light? What does that mean about creation? What does that mean about creation? Creation is an act of will. And that's what it means when Jews say, and God said, let there be light. Like, you actually believe God. Am I supposed to take that literally, or is that metaphorically? Whatever it is, in its utmost sense, it means, of course, the Chumash is written in the language of the human being. But in terms of the language of the human being, what is that telling us? It's telling us that creation is an act of will. Okay? Number one. Number two, what else is creation? What is one of the first things we see in the process of creation? Because by God saying, let there be light, that tells us there's an intention over it. Let there be light. That's all. It's simple enough that if you think too much about it, it won't make any sense. It's just like, you have to understand that creation is an act of will. And that might seem very, you know, obviously, but not obviously. As we will see in the later stage when Shabbos is created, why is Shabbos so important? Why is Shabbos so important in terms of the fulfillment, the establishment of the world? Without a Shabbos, the world would have gone back into its original form of chaos. So just keep in mind that creation is an act of will, and that will make more sense when we start to deal with Shabbos. Number one. Number two, what's the next step of creation? What does God do in a creative process? So the first thing we see is V'yavdel Elohim. Beina oro, beina choshech. And God created a distinction between light and darkness. And then the next thing we see in the creative process is what? And God called the light day and the darkness night. So what is that? Categorization. Okay? What else happens in the process of creation? Again, we see that God puts the firmament between the waters. Again, separation, divisions, distinctions. And in verse 10, what do we see over here? God gathers the water into one place. What is that? It's grouping, which is categorization. It's demarcation. Here's the end of the waters, here will be the land, okay? And then what do we see? You see a process. It starts off with distinction. Then it moves into categorization. Then it moves into separation. Right? Then it moves into demarcation. Right? And then what does it move into? Okay, the whole time God keeps saying it's good, it's good, it's good. Now why do you think God has to say it's good? Okay, before we get to multiplication, let's just, that's true. That's exactly the next step. We see multiplication. We see things moving from very simple forms to multiple forms. First there was light, then there's darkness, then there's this water, but then it's split. Right? And then all of a sudden, what do you have? You have multiplication in terms of grass, and grass producing to its own species. So there's now, what does it mean that grass is producing to its own species? Well, it separates again, but it's identification. In other words, you know, everything's according to its species. You will see that word according to its species about five or six times. And if the Torah repeats it, it means like this is very crucial for creation. For something to be created, it has to be a certain dedication, establishment of identities. This is what it is, and it'll continue to be that way. But not only does God create diversification, but creates a process of diversification. Do you see this? How did God create a process of diversification? Yeah, but more than that. Because what does God say that the earth is going to do? The earth is going to produce diversification of grass. And the grass itself is going to give seeds, which itself will produce diversification, but still a dedication to identity. Okay. So it's becoming diversified, multiplied, and yet there's this dedication to identities and definitions. Right? This is what creation means. Right? If you don't know what this means, you don't know what it means to continue the process of creation. Right? Because the process of creation is definitely coming to definitions and clarity, accepting diversity and dedication to identity. And if you don't know that, you don't know what creation is. Right? And most people in their lives spend most of their lives trying to remain what? Undefined. Right? And you're not in the world of creation if you want to remain undefined. And you're not in the world of creation if you feel, well, anything goes. It doesn't matter. What's the difference between this or that? What's the difference? If you live in a world where you say, what's the difference? You don't live in a world that's created. Right? In a world that's a big bang, then of course, what could you say? What's the difference? A world which is a product of a big bang, there is no difference between this or that. But if you qualitatively experience a difference in the world, then you have just tasted what creation is. And to the point that you're willing to make a difference in the world, and to the point that you're willing to understand what makes you different, and yet what makes you similar in terms of dedication to your species, which happens to be Jewish, right? And to that extension, you're part of the creative process. We have to understand what creativity is. Right? Because what generally is creativity in the world? New forms of creativity, there seems to be a lack of direction. I remember I once saw a show about this guy, and he's famous because what he does is he throws a bunch of paint on the canvas, and then he gets a bunch of live worms. And he dumps them on the paint. The live worms, of course, are going like this and that, and he sells them for like, who knows, a couple $1,000s. He gives a cut to the worms, but ultimately, you know, he signs it. He should sign the worm, right? Creation is that process of diversification, definitions. Categorization. And so why does God see it and say it's good? Why does God have to say it's good? Well, so what would bad be? Why would there have to be a separation of bad? So for God to say, and God saw it and was good, that would imply what? It could have possibly be bad. God looked at it and said it's good, which means that in Gemara language, there was like a possibility that it was bad. God looked at it and said, no, this is good. If anybody here thinks that this is bad, you're wrong, because God said very clearly, he saw it and he said it's good. Now, why would I think it was bad? But it, okay, when we look at the world, we might say it's bad. But when we look at this world that God's creating, why does the Chumash confirm, and this is good, and God said this is good? Yeah, but what it implies here there would have been what we call a havamina. We could have thought that there's something bad here, but the Torah establishes, God puts his picture and says, no, this is good. You know, like you walk into one of these falafel stores and say, oh, it doesn't look like this is kosher, right? And God says, no, it's kosher. So too, while I'm reading the story, for some reason it implies, and God looked at it and said, it's good. Saw it was good, meaning that there was a possibility that there could have been bad, otherwise there would be no meaning to, and it was good if there was no concept of bad. Is that not correct? For it to say, and God saw it was good, would imply that there's now the reality, the possibility of evil, but God looked at it and said, no, it's really good. Why is it good? Because evil is separation, and isn't this process a process which is generally what's seen as evilness? Isn't evilness breaking things into pieces and defining, and you're a this, and judging and saying this is a that? Isn't that what evil is? Isn't this process, which seems to be a force of separation, isn't it in essence the very ground and root of all evil in the world? And yet God says it's good. Why is it good? And it comes to Tov Me'od. Very good when we get to it. We'll see that in a second. So you have to understand that creation, on one hand, at first glance, we'll take a second glance, we'll see a whole other force moving in the opposite direction. At first glance, we would see creation as a process of, first of all, it's a process of will. Second of all, it's a process of distinction and categorization and then separation and then demarcation and definition and then multiplicity and diversity and yet dedication to particularity. So these things are becoming more particularized. Right? Now what else do we see over here in the process of creation? We move from light and we're moving forward. Right? We get to like fish, birds, animals, man. What do you see happening over here? What else do you see happening in terms of the kinds of things emerging on the stage of reality? What is going on over here? First of all, each one is becoming more complex and more individualized. Right? All light looks alike. Right? Unless you go through various glass, but light is light. It is the most universal. Light is the most universal. It is the most simplest form. Light is energy, and if I break it all down, it's all energy. What's it all? And yet somehow now there's darkness, there's light. Things seem to be graduating towards individuality. From dirt to flowers. And a flower is less individual than an animal. Why? Because of its mobility. And you see that things are more dependent. There is more basic things like the grass is dependent on the ground and is drawing from the ground. But then all of a sudden you have these fish, where they're kind of more mobile, but they're still dependent on the water. And then you see animals which are more mobile, and in terms of the way they look, in terms of species-wise, right? Human beings are the most individualized of them all. Every human being looks completely different. To a certain extent, yes and no. Because ultimately, the human being is the most independent because they have freedom. They have freedom. So when I'm moving from a process of distinction, categorization, and diversification, multiplicity, but then we're going into qualitative difference, not only quantitative difference, but qualitative difference in terms of what does pru or vu mean? Pru means what? To be fruitful, from the word pri. Or vu, what does that mean? Why does it say pru or vu? Right? Be fruitful and multiply. What's the difference? Fruitful, multiply. So what's the difference? The word ravu, what is it? Do you know, can you think of a word that's connected to the word ravu? Also, because argument is multiplicity. Right? So it's connected to rav. But what else is rav? What? Many. What else is rav? A rav. What does a teacher have to do with pru or vu? Right? So Rav Shimshon Frohl Hirsch explains that revu, pru means a quantitative increase, and revu means a qualitative increase. An educator wants to help you discover your unique identity and increase unique identities. Create unique identities. And the human being is entrusted with the ultimate, even though the fish were also blessed with pru or vu, the human being is the ultimate manifestation of the creative process. And what is a creative process? An ongoing graduation of multiplicity and diversity and dedication to identities. Okay? That's what creation seems to be. And each graduating stage in creation is becoming more and more independent. Less and less dependent on the earth. To a certain extent, we would say that the human being is the animal that is ultimately able to stand erect. Every other animal seems to be parallel with the ground, drawing from the ground, their face to the ground, right? And the human being is this inverted tree, where the human being ultimately starts to draw into themselves the power of divinity, which is the power of independence, the power to create more independence in the world. So that seems to be the process of it. Seems to be the process. Now, we want to look at it on another level. Let's look at the creation of the human kind. So this is now verse 26, chapter 1. So everything seemed to be graduating towards particularism, individuality, right? Uniqueness. Right? I mean, animals of same species generally look the same. Right? Sheep look generally the same. But as we graduate in creation, things seem to be very unique. So the quality of uniqueness seems to be part of what it means to be creative. Right? Of course, that's what originality is, and that's why this painting, which is unique, nobody else has that painting. But we're going to discover now what really makes something unique. What is true unique? So everyone wants to be unique, right? That's the thing to be these days. So what does it mean to be unique? We're going to see. Right? By just simply looking at this, the Torah is giving us direction in terms of the fundamental motives we anyways had. Yomer Elohim, God said, Naseh Adam B'Tzelmeinu, Kidmuteinu, V'yudu B'Gat Hayam, let's make man in our image, and in our likeness, and he will, Yirdu B'Gat Hayam, and he will rule over the fish of the sea, U'Ba'af HaShemayim, the birds of the heavens, U'Baheima, and the animals, ubuchola aretz, and all the land, and all the creepy crawly things. What does one have to do with the other? Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and he will rule over the world. Right? So, he will rule over the world must mean what? What is that going to help us understand? What it means to be creating God's likeness. Follow. Right? Because they're in the same pasuk. So it's very clear over here. Let's create man in our image. That's beautiful. And he will rule, meaning that being creating God's image has this implication or is reflected in this ability. Okay. But of course there's something here in this pasuk that is very difficult. Astounding. Which is what? Let us. Let us. What is the plural sense over here? And how does this differ from any other type of creation? In all the other days of creation, what did God say? Let there be, let there be, let there be. Was there this preparation? Okay, let us now, right, create man. That already gives us something about the humankind. Something about the humankind in terms of it being at least a statement of what? Before that, just the let us. Forget about the us. It means let us create man. Even if God would say, let me create man. Right? Forget about the us for now. But until now, God didn't say, let me create light. Right? Let there be light. But let me create man. What if the pasuk would have said, let me? We're just dissecting it and seeing what could it have said. And what it should have said, or what we would expect to say, is let there be man. But it didn't say that. What did it then say? Let us. So, if it's saying let us, what would we at least expect? We would certainly never expect the us. If it's already saying let us, we would at the very least hear let me. Right? Let me create man. So, if it would have said let me create man, let's not get confused about let us. What would that mean? Let me create man. In contrast to let there be light, there's a difference. Well, wouldn't God know what light is all about and trees are all about? Forget about the make. We're just looking on the let me, which hasn't happened until now. What would be the further pshat? It's just simply reading this. And that's what I said. Learning how to learn is reading it. What did you think it could have said? What did it say? And the various possibilities. Doesn't it suggest, and of course the commentaries are going to say, a preparation. Now let me create man. It's like a person, well, let there be this, let there be that, let there be that. Now, let me. It is the culmination of everything that's happened. Right? Man is not just another day of creation. Okay, it's Friday. Okay, let's, you know, got to create man. But it's like day one, day two, now let me create man. Right? The let me is already the beginning. It's not like allow me, although that's another pshat. Right? That's another pshat. Allow me, which is that God asked the angels. He took counsel with the angels. Who's us? Let us create man. That the Midrash says God took derech eretz, you know, it's only manners. No, you ask the angels. You don't just go around creating man like that. Of course, God didn't ask the angel about light. They don't care about light. God didn't ask the angel about grass. Who cares about grass? Angels couldn't care. But let us make man is that God took counsel from the angels and said, come on, let's go. Let's do this together. And somehow, like, directing them, and that itself is an interesting midrash, but I won't go into. But the let me also implies a certain preparation, a certain direct expression. Rather than let there be that, let there be this, let there be that, but now, right, let me create man, or let us create man, implies a certain preparation. This is what everything was building towards. A human being. The apex of a creative process is the ability to create that which is truly unique. That which is independent. Number one. Number two, let's now deal with the let us. Who could God be referring to? So we just suggested, although you could not have figured that out from the text, the let us is referring to angels. But who could God also be referring to? Yes?
So God and man created.
Would everyone agree with that as being a shot, a simple understanding, or an understanding, but that has to be pushed a little bit? Because at first reading, We on a pshat level, on a drush level, it's completely acceptable. Right? And it's exactly one of the things we'll discuss. But on a pshat level, who else is around for God to say this to? All of creation. All of creation. This, of course, is one of the other commentaries. Right? Who is God speaking to? The totality of creation. Let us now all make man. What does that mean mankind is? A microcosm of the totality of the universe. Mankind includes everything. And this is their true uniqueness. Real uniqueness is the ability to include. Why? Two things that are opposites. Are they unique? Is black unique of white? Would that be proper to say that they're truly unique? Why? Because part of its definition is within the same category. In other words, for two things to be opposites, it means they belong to the same order of being. And if we're not really completely unique, because you still belong to the same club. In order for us to be opposites, we got to belong to the same club. Otherwise, there's no way, there's no place to meet. For us to even be opposite in the first place. Real uniqueness is the ability to be all-inclusive. What's unique about you is you are everything and even more. Man is the whole that is greater than the sum of all the parts of the universe. And that's important to understand. Because that is how man is the image of God. Is God... The divine realm is the realm of Kedusha, the realm of holiness that includes within it the possibility of all creation, the possibility and the freedom to express it and to bring it into reality. The divine is an all-encompassing reality that includes the world and transcends the world. And the human being is a whole greater than sum of the parts. Naseh Adam B'Tzelmeinu means that everything contributed to the human being, and that ultimately the human being is a whole that's greater than all the sums of the parts. Now, it's very interesting to know that the human being was created as an individual. Everything else was created in species. Now, and yet somehow all that multiplicity came into a one human being. In other words, the human being isn't just another particular amongst the list of all the other particularities. What is the human being? The human being becomes the context that includes the entire universe. When you look at a human being, you will see reflected in them the entire universe. Nase Adam B'Tzelmeinu, God is now calling forth all the various particulars to come together in this one individual who is unique in that he incorporates all of creation. But does that mean he's like all creation? No, he's so unique. He's completely different. He's the whole that's greater than the sum of all those parts. That's true uniqueness. True uniqueness is the ability to include the world. Black is not unique of white. What's really unique is that which is colorless and that includes both of them. That's really unique. It does not belong to the same order. It transcends it and includes it. Now what's really going on here are two forces. Because the truth is that every stage of creation includes the earlier stage. Because within the vegetation is included the mineral. And the force of vegetation is included within the animal. And the animal is actually included within the human being. So as things become more and more individualized, their individuality is a function of the fact that they actually become more all-inclusive. And whereas on one hand we would see creation as becoming more particularized from a universal whole, the divine union, God created heaven and the earth, this great whole universal reality, everything unfolds into a particularism. With every step down into particularism, there becomes a new step upwards in things becoming more all-inclusive and more universal. And that really creation is a process of diversification on one hand, which is called in Kabbalah the force of Gevurot, the force of separation and distinction and particularism, and yet coming from the other direction is another force, an opposing force, which is a force called in Kabbalah Chasadim, which is the force of unification and holism. And when you look at creation, it's actually going in these directions. Whereas on one hand, if you look at it, it seems like it's becoming more and more particularized. And in the end, what you come up with is something that's really particular. And what's particular about it is that it's the most universal and includes the whole of creation. Includes the whole of creation. This is what's called in Kabbalah, Or Yashar and Or Chozer. That on one hand, the light seems to be unfolding into particularism. On the other hand, every step it goes down, it seems to be returning back to its original universalism. Do you follow this? Very deep idea to understand the process of creation. That's why it's actually good. Because what's good about it is it's actually a manifestation of a greater oneness. A oneness that includes the multiplicity and it still remains one. That's the greater oneness. That's a real creative process. A real creative process is to paint a picture that on one hand has all these various details, on the other hand it has this comprehensive whole. Where the detail enhances the whole, and the whole enhances the detail. And although the creative process seems to be putting things into very specific places and demarking and making it very specific, things become more and more specific, and yet somehow things become more and more comprehensive at the same time. Now these two forces, people don't understand, they work together. People think that they're different forces. Either you're into unity or you're into separateness. And that separateness isn't actually part of a process going the other direction of unity. So what really is happening is being that God is the most universal of all realities, the all-inclusive one original reality. And what this God creates is a process which becomes and unfolds into a particularism, as from universal, it seems to be going towards particular. With every step down towards the particular, there is a greater, an even greater manifestation of the universal. That's how God is manifest in the world. That's how creation manifests God. By giving reality to particularism, and how every particularism actually reflects an even greater unity at the same time. This itself is the greatest act of divinity. So Naseh Adam B'Tzelmeinu is the culmination of all this, where we all of a sudden see everything seems to be becoming unique and individualized, and as we're just coming to the very bottom of individualism and separateness and independence, we end up with the most universal of all creations that include them all, and this is his individuality. This is the very individuality. In fact, although I wouldn't bring it up too much, but even astrologically, what is the last sign? Pisces. Last sign is Pisces. And the last sign, which is Pisces, in fact, is an individual that includes all the other signs, and that's their individuality. That's one of the lessons Pisces have to learn in their lives, that they seem to play so many different roles that they wonder whether they're an individual at all. Because I can be a this, I can be a that. That's why Purim, which is connected to Pisces, is wearing various... Very good. That the Pisces can wear masks on Purim. Because the Pisces can play so many different roles, they wonder whether they have any identity whatsoever. The highest level is when the Pisces understands that their identity is precisely a whole greater than all the sum of those parts. And so to over here, the human being, the Naseh, seems to be so individual, and his individuality is precisely because, and his uniqueness is precisely because he incorporates the totality of the universe. Now, what does it mean to be an individual? It tells us right here. Everyone wants to be an individual. Well, generally, people think an individual means I'm a this to the exclusion of you're that. See, I'm such an individual. You're not such an individual because you're the opposite of me. So we still belong to the same game. An individual, a true unique human being, is a person that discovers the entire universe and every other human being inside themselves. And when you get to that point, you're a unique person. An individual, the true unique individual that will come on the stage of the world, and that unique individual will be in fact the image of God, will be at the point where you will discover that you include the whole world. That you will find that every other individual in the world is so much part of your identity. That's when you're really unique. That's a unique person. Everybody else is the same. They're fighting to be different. And that's what makes you all the same. As I once mentioned, they interviewed a woman. She was dressed up like Madonna on the street. He asked her, why are you dressed like Madonna? And she said, I'm expressing my individuality. Everyone's the same. You're all the same because you're trying to be different. The same thing. Trying to be different. What's really unique is when you incorporate within yourself all the differences and you can transcend it and yet still hold it together. Then you're in the image of God. Because that is what God is. God is the place of the world. God includes the totality of creation within himself, so to speak. God is the place of the world, so it says. Mekomo shel olam. And when are you going to be in the image of God? When you become the place of the world. Rather than fighting with the world, accommodate the world. Accommodate everybody else's individuality. When you do that, you're creating. So what we see over here is creation is actually two forces going in a complete different direction. There's Or Yashar, which is this unfolding, this unraveling towards greater and greater independence, greater and greater uniqueness, greater and greater particularism, to the point we end up with this individual one man, not even a species, one man. The interesting thing is this one man is unique and particular in that he is the greatest of all wholes. That he is the most universal, all-inclusive of everything else. This is creation. That's what it means. Now we go to what Jane said. Nasedam b'tzalmenu. God is also speaking to us. When we're reading this now, this was written after the facts, not before. This is written to us. God says, now, let us make man in our image. We are part of the creative process. How will we be part of the creative process? When we begin to unify the world, when we begin to bring together all those individual parts, that's when God said, Tov Ma'od. Now it's very good. Every act of separation was actually an act of goodness because the separation was in the direction of unification. Every separation, every step down was actually another step up towards an even greater vision of unity. Greater vision of harmony. No big deal to be harmonious when everybody's the same. Real harmony is when we're different and yet it's still working together. And God looked and said, that's good. You say, what's so good about it? There's darkness, there's light, this does its form, that does its deal. Everything's becoming more and more specified and determined and distinguished. And God said, no, it's good. And you know what? In the end, it's very good. And how do we make sure it's very good when we participate in Nasa Adam B'Tzalmenu? That we are also part of continuing the process. What is the process of creation, really? The process of creation is the unraveling from the most universal realm, all-inclusive, one unique realm, divinity, as the unfolding of that into the most specific, most particularized, most physical, and yet at every step down, it begins to find itself moving in the other direction, back to the most universal. That is the ultimate creation of Am Yisrael. God said in the beginning, God created heaven and the earth. We end up with Yom HaShishi. The oral tradition says, the sixth day, referring to Torah. When the Jewish people will accept the Torah, then creation will really continue. It'll go on. Because the image of creation is from the most universal to the particular, back to the most universal. But that back isn't the same universal. How will it be different? How will it be different? Because it'll be the universal that includes the particular in its full identity. Never be the same. Never be the same. What's happening over here is the universal divine creates the particular, and the particular begins to reflect more and more the universal and encompass the universal. It's almost like one of Escher's drawings, which I should have brought in. Escher has a drawing of a person in an art gallery, looking at themselves. They're looking at a picture, which is a picture of themselves looking at a picture. Almost this idea over here of this divine process of creativity, where the particular is created, an expression of the whole, and the whole is then once again expressed through the particular. And that will be the ultimate vision that we will see.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.